What's going on, everyone? Welcome to another episode of Conspiracy or Just a Coincidence. I am Jack Allen. First, go follow me on Twitter at Kojak Podcast, on Instagram at Kojak Podcast, and all the links are in the show notes. You know, again, I made this joke already, but damn, whoever started this, I think it was kind of pointless because, you know, you get the same listeners every day pretty much, and they can just click on the links in the show notes. But anyway, go follow me. You want to support the show? Awesome. If you can leave a review, that means just as much. So please, if you can rank the show or whatever, you know what it's called. But today's episode, I was so looking forward to it, and it did not let me down. I brought on a communist, or he called a Marxist-Leninist, who's into conspiracies. His name is Your Conspiracy Dad, or Your Conspiracy, Your Communist Dad, and I'll put his link in the show notes. Super intelligent guy. He was awesome. He killed it, dude. He was so awesome. We talked about Operation Gladio, and then we kind of got, I'm not a good host. I leave it off, you know, I got him off topic and was talking more Marxist theory and stuff, but it was also very interesting. A lot of stuff that I totally agreed with. So it's interesting that these different view, we can read the same stuff because we met through this Operation Gladio book. And we both took different things from it. So I really found it awesome. If you don't know much about communism, besides like the boomer communism stuff, definitely check this out. And Brad talks about all these beliefs that I believe in. Like, I don't believe that people working 40 hours a week at Wendy's, who when I used to work at Wendy's, you know, the manager or whatever, should be able to barely survive. I believe anyone that works deserves to live in a house that they own for their family and to go on a vacation every now and again and to do fun things. I don't think people deserve who work 40 hours a week to need to work paycheck to paycheck. And I think the only disagreement Brad and I would have was how do we get there? And I'm of the ilk that it's the central banking's fault and his is it's capitalism's fault. And there's truth to both sides of this. So it's an awesome show. Definitely listen out. I also love that our community, we need to reach across the aisle because we cannot take the same faults that our parents do. Not all parents, obviously, but people like on the right, the Fox watching people, anytime they hear these words, it's bad. Ooh, you know, they're holding up the sign of the cross like it's the devil. We need to grow past this, right? We need to figure out what needs to be done because we know this world. This is what we can all agree on. The CIA sucks. The robber barons suck, and they are screwing up our world. This world doesn't need to be this way, and that's why we have these like kind of extremes of communism and libertarianism, because we all recognize that the system's beyond broken. It's beyond broken, and I would do whatever to fix this. Like I just said, people deserve. If you work, you deserve to be able to buy a house. You deserve to be able to buy your car. You know, obviously not a mansion or a Lexus, but the system's broken, dude. It's so broken. And I'm getting off topic. This was an awesome show. Go follow Brad at Your Communist Dad. Super smart guy. Go follow him. We're going to bring him on again to talk more conspiracy heavy stuff, but this was good. I needed a background of where he was coming from. So I love the show. Love the guy. He's awesome. And that's it, guys. So go follow him. Go follow me at Kojak Podcast. I love y'all. God bless. We'll talk soon. Peace. What's going on, everyone? Welcome to another episode of Conspiracy or Just a Coincidence. I am Jack Allen. So today I have like literally been so excited for this show all week. This is with my fellow Twitter follower or mutual Brad at Your Communist Dad. So as you can tell by the username, we're coming from a different side of the aisle, but I'm just so excited to hear your take, dude, on communism and conspiracy. So first, thanks for coming on the show. And how are you doing today?
Yeah, thanks for having me on, Jack. This is a fun topic for me. Some gnarly history at play here, and definitely an intersection of, you know, some of my interests in terms of history, just nefarious shit, and just kind of like Marxism and how that all kind of has shaken out, I don't know, grammar, over the years.
Well, dude, so I love, because all like, first, I mean, I want to hear your like, how you got into conspiracies, because it seems like conspiracies, they tend to lead to this, mm-hmm. The goal is the global communists One World Government. So I want to hear first how you got into conspiracies and like about you, because this is the first time we're talking. And so if you don't mind telling everybody about yourself, all those good things.
Sure. No problem. So as you may have guessed, I've not always been your communist dad. I've been kind of all over. I grew up in like a more conservative home.
Okay.
In college, you had like a libertarian phase, you know, kind of a new atheist type of guy, then became like a progressive liberal. I was like a DSA guy for a minute, and then now I consider myself a Marxist-Leninist specifically, and so like kind of the perspective I'm coming from reflects that. And yeah, as far as like how I kind of got there, not to basically it's like I've always like had like a soft spot, just like always like cared about like people and suffering in a way. Even when I was a little kid, my parents always said, oh, you've got such a tender heart. And I've always been like, I'm very kind of like, I'm a STEM guy, I'm a computer programmer, a STEM background. And so I've always wanted to connect my like moral kind of interest and with like a scientific understanding of like why the world is the way it is. And so like endlessly asking a question, well, why is that, is kind of what has gotten me slowly and surely to like Marxism, and also has gotten me lately into learning a bit more about some of these kind of conspiracy things, some stuff like Operation Gladio or any of the countless very real world conspiracies that have tended to you know, target movements that I actually would probably be supportive of, whether it's the Sandinistas or you know, the communists in Italy. Yeah, so that's kind of my background, how I got here.
Dude, I love it. It's like I'm fascinated by you. So I'm already so I'm going to be all over, because I'm so excited to start. Well, so we'll start with Gladio, because that was, you know, what I that was your first post on Twitter. And that's what like was like, what the heck? This guy's talking about Operation Gladio, but his handle is your communist dad. So for anyone that doesn't know, Gladio was this, it started in the 50s, right after World War II, a lovely guy by the name of Paul Helliwell, who also helped Disney get his land, came up with this brilliant idea how to fund the war against communism. And they were going to sell drugs. So he said, but let's only put it in lower income areas, which tended to be African-American, because that's okay. So we did that and kept going for, I think it's still going on now. I'm still convinced the CIA is bringing in all the drugs, but that's a quick, would you think that's a good overview of Gladio, a quick 30-second view of Gladio?
Yeah. I'd also add that they hooked up with former fascists across Western Europe, who had originally, it was like the Nazis themselves were planning these, and they were going to bury caches of weapons and dynamite so that when the communists invaded, which is something they claimed to believe for a very long time would happen, but CIA documents reveal they knew never was actually a real military threat, but they used it for propaganda purposes. But if the communists did come to power one way or another, they could conduct essentially terrorist operations and kind of wreak lots of havoc as a stay-behind network.
Right.
So yeah, they hooked up with the Vatican. They laundered lots of this drug money. And because they didn't really want congressional oversight over this kind of thing, and they didn't want to alienate their European allies, it's kind of a bad look when you're like arming terrorists in your ostensible allies' country. They tend to frown on that. So they couldn't do it above board. So they had to, you know, go underground with them, have this alternate revenue stream that was not subject to, you know, public scrutiny.
Dude, I love how the hate of the CIA has brought two people from different ends of the political spectrum together. That's beauty, dude. That is beauty.
Yeah. Here we are.
But so how, like, for let's, we'll start like right in the beginning of Gladio, because that was after World War II. So why, because in my mind, I don't think that there is an actual, I think this war against communism was made up, that the CIA needed an enemy. Alan Dulles needed he wanted an organization that he could serve the bankers with. And this was the most convenient enemy to choose because of many reasons why I think they supported communism. So why do you think, let's say though, it was an actual war against communism, why is the US and the West making this battle again, and these, and probably your idea in your frame of mind, like lies about communism?
Sure. So in the shortest answer would be like I would definitely take very seriously. For me, I would take at face value that like the United States, the CIA was very earnest in their pursuit of the war against communism. And I think that it's because Marxism or any really anti-imperialist project does represent a very real threat to the material interests of the ruling class as a whole. And so, if let's say the nations of Africa had been able to unite under Pan-African leaders, people like Patrice Lumumba, Amilcar Cabral, who were assassinated, some of them through gladio-related
I'm sure.
programs. If
I'm sure.
Africa had been able to be united, then the West is no longer able to suck the cobalt and the just the various resources out of Africa, and it would economically hurt. It would cause a lot of like unrest at home, and it would ultimately compromise the power base of like the imperialists. So, yeah, in a sense, like these projects do represent a very real threat to them. It's not. There definitely are times where they exaggerate the threat. For instance, like in the 80s with the Sandinistas, Ronald Reagan administration pretended like and convinced everyone that this army of like 100,000 like peasant guerrillas were gonna like cut a swath up through Mexico and like invade the United States, which is just patently absurd, but
Right, absolutely.
they needed to, they do need to ratchet up the fear. So to me, it's like that. It's like they need to ratchet up the fear beyond what the actual threat is, but they are also like genuinely threatened by these alternative systems and alternative ways of structuring the processes of production and distribution and the way that society is run on an economic level, if that
So
makes sense.
I would totally agree with, like, in that in, or the book we're referencing, that they talk about Guatemala, and I'm sure you got that part. And so you correct me where you think I'm wrong, but so in my mind, these leaders that they often assassinated, they would call them communists, but they really weren't communists, right? They were more nationalist leaders. Like, I forget the Guatemalan guy's name, but like
Jacobo
I
Arbenz, yeah.
what was his name?
Jacobo Arbenz, the Arbenz
Yes.
government.
Yeah. And they ruined that guy's life. I mean, I think he like ended up killing himself because in a bathtub. I mean, they
I think
tortured this
so.
guy. And but I would support him if that like happened today. But do you think he was he actually, I thought they just kind of labeled him a communist because
No, you're
that,
totally right.
okay.
Yeah, that's exactly true. Like if you were so like when the Truman administration comes into power right after the war, they initially have this policy. Oh, so there's a really great book I'd recommend actually on this
Well, yeah.
topic that goes through this, but it's really great because it's a view from 10,000 feet. It's a global view
Love it.
of all of these kinds of things. So like it fits a Gladio fits into it really well, and it crosses from like the economic, political, and conspiratorial. It's called The Darker Nations by Vijay Prashad.
I'm looking that
And
up
I don't know
right
if there's
now.
a good way for me to actually, I have a document that I put like some notes kind of together. I
Yeah.
may share it afterwards, like in a comment or whatnot. I've got a lot
I'd
of
love to.
links
Yeah.
to
Awesome.
lots of books, videos, podcasts, that kind of thing.
Perfect.
But yeah, in The Darker Nations, he talks about how basically prior to World War II, you have a this era of colonialism and imperialism. And that is when even the very idea of quote unquote the West as this a cohesive whole emerges out of this process. And it's this process where you have feudalism evolving into capitalism, you have this new merchant class, they start trading, they get really good at navigating the seas, they discover the Americas, and they find conditions that they are able to exploit to a historically unprecedented degree. The difference in disease and in military technology is so great that they're able to very quickly dominate. And then they take those resources back to Europe. They start going to Africa. They need a labor force because they've killed off so many indigenous people. The slave trade starts. You have the triangle trade. And in the middle of this, you start to see the emergence of capitalism, right? And so in Europe itself, you start to see the invention of manufacturers, where you're no longer producing things as an individual blacksmith. Now you've got a whole bunch of blacksmiths in a manufacturer working together and producing stuff more quickly, right?
Yeah.
And so you can produce stuff for cheap. So then all these places they've colonized, like for instance, India, they used to produce like their weaving and looms and all that shit. They had their own textile industry, right? Well, the British come in, they break the thumbs of the weavers and sell them cheap Manchester products, and it destroys their local economy. So it's kind of like, you know, like growing up conservative, like that, you know, that that saying of just like, you know, teach a man to fish, feed him for a day, or, you know, give a man to fish, feed him for a day, teach a man to fish. Well, that's like kind of how like imperialist, colonialist economics and politics work. It's all about destroying native industry by forcing them to accept free trade with military force, because they've got the factory advantage back home. So like if you can produce by hand a yard of linen in I'm a Marxist, so I love to talk about yards of linen. if it takes one you an hour to produce a yard of linen, and then I'm working on like a power loom and I can produce 100 yards of linen in that same hour, well, I've just destroyed the economic value of your yard of linen by 100-fold, and so it creates this economic dependency. So that kind of process has been playing out, and it's pretty one-sided until it kind of culminates in like right before World War I. You've got the whole world is essentially colonized by these European Western powers, and then starting to include the United States, and Japan gets in on the game too, right?
Yeah.
But then they've colonized all the world. So now if you want, and like the thing driving it is like capital has to expand, like business has to, profits must go up. Right.
Right.
And you know, what do you do if you saturated your market? Well, you can invest in advertising to try to convince people they need more shoes than they really do. Or you can expand into a foreign market.
Yeah.
So for all these countries have all their capitals and they have to expand somewhere. And if all the world's been colonized by your competitors, what's the only way that your capital can expand is by taking your competitors. So that, as like a Marxist, and this is one of the things that really blew my mind and really to me solidified like, oh, this stuff is like makes so much sense. It was like, that is literally what caused World War I.
Can you elaborate on that?
Yeah. So there's this really great book. It's only like 120 pages. And I think that like conspiracy heads really like it because he talks about banks a lot.
Oh, it's yes. Lenin. We love
them. Lenin himself wrote a book called Imperialism, the Highest Stage of Capitalism. And what he does is he looks at the observations that Marx made about capitalism. Because like Marx is basically the Isaac Newton of economics and history, except he's also kind of like, he's like a mix between like Isaac Newton, but then also, you know, those like, you know, like those the clickbaity ads that are like, mom discovers secret to healthy skin, dermatologist's
secret. Yes.
So, I mean, that's all goofy and silly. And we all know, okay, that's probably not really what's going on. But no, like, that's like literally what Karl Marx is and what Marxism is.
Hilarious. Is like,
he figured out how this stuff worked, but his conclusions were extremely inconvenient for the people who had all the political power. And so like after Marx, they literally divided what he studied, which was called, used to be called political economy. That's what Adam Smith and David Ricardo talked about. And that's who Marx was mostly building off of and critiquing at the same time. But they split political economy into political science, sociology, and economics. Because when you looked at them all together, you came to the conclusions Marx did, which is, hey, this capitalism thing is going to eventually tear itself apart, and you're not going to have this capitalist bourgeois ruling class and the proletariat. So what's going to happen is the workers are learning to organize their own production. You know, the capitalist doesn't, the certain person who owns the company may not even know how anything is done at the company. It's just like workers doing all that shit. And so eventually they're going to kind of take over. That's kind of his conclusion. But Lenin took what Marx studied about like capital and the way capital and labor work together and how capital like exploits labor to accumulate more capital, and your capital is always growing. And he applied that and looked at how all these banks had taken over the industrial capital and how basically all, and then all the banks, the big banks eat the little banks, and the big businesses eat the little businesses. And there's this inherent tendency towards monopoly capitalism.
Yes.
And then the banks come in, and they because they aren't tied to a single industry, banking finance capital begins to emerge, where they say, hey, we are going to basically kind of take over this one branch of industry. And because we have the advantage of, we can lose money in this one sector until our competitors go out of business, and then we buy them up because we have investment in other places. So like Lenin took that and he looked at how all the colonies had gotten together, and he's like, oh, look, well, British capital, French capital, German capital, Japanese capital, all these different capitals are looking to expand, and they have to, in order to like divide the world amongst them, they have to redivide it by like military conquest. You know, and for that reason, you know, 30 million people died on the battlefields of Europe. And it was largely about getting access to all these colonies. One of the big things in the Treaty of Versailles is Germany loses her African colonies. And so that puts Germany in this really crazy place for the interwar period, where they still have this massive industrial base, but they've lost the ability to export their goods to the colonies, and they've lost their ability to get cheap labor and resources from the colonies back into their factories. So their economy is extremely unstable. Mm. And that's like what Hitler takes advantage of. And he says, hey, what we got to do is we're going to do colonialism in Eastern Europe. We're going to do what the United States did with Manifest Destiny, but we're going to do it to all of the Slavs, and we're going to kill the Jews while we're at it. And so basically he's just trying to do colonialism, but all the other European powers who did the same thing in like the Belgian Congo or like, you know, in Africa and Southeast Asia, they're very upset at the idea of doing it in Europe. But yeah, basically like at the end of World War II, though, all of these colonial powers had beaten themselves up so bad. The Soviet Union emerges, and who emerges as the most powerful nation in the world? It's the United States, you know? And so there's this weird period where like the United States has a bit of a different model, where we don't like to directly control territory. We prefer to do like it's called neocolonialism.
Right.
And so like our banks and our companies will own the mines. And then Europe, the European powers did not have the economic and military force to defend their colonies anymore. So Britain basically says, hey, if you forgive our debt that we racked up during the war with the Lend-Lease program, we will open up the British Empire, our markets, to your capital. So the United States becomes this really weird new hegemonic financial capitalist power that doesn't directly control all that much territory, but enters these kind of client state relationships with Western Europe and with lots and lots of these puppet governments. Mm-hmm. But because the colonies are beginning to gain political independence, a lot of these countries, like in Guatemala, looping back, sorry, people like Arbenz, or people like Sukarno in Indonesia, or Modi in India, Nasser in Egypt, some of these third world, you have the rise of what's called the third world movement. And this period right after the end of World War II until like the mid 70s is one of the most crazy periods of history, because this American system of imperial domination has not yet solidified. And all of these countries where they had been under this brutal colonial rule, they're beginning to assert themselves. And for a minute, the ruling class, the bourgeoisie of these countries and the workers, they share a common interest. And that interest is, wouldn't it be great if Unilever didn't own all of our shit, and we could use our own resources to make ourselves, our lives better, you know, like you read about like in Guatemala. And Arbenz was like, Arbenz was just one of those guys. He's like, yeah, it would be cool if all of our wealth wasn't getting sucked off into like some bank in New York or London. And the CIA is like, nope, actually you are a communist and we have to kill you or take you out.
Well, dude, I think in the perfect example is like Castro. Like the U.S. press loved Castro. They fly him to New York City.
Oh yeah.
And you probably, I don't know what did he do that then it's sweat. Okay, and then it's, then they try to trap him in New York, and then they, what did he do that pissed him off?
Oh my gosh. I'm sorry. I'm always recommending shit. There's season two of, there's this podcast called Blowback.
Okay.
And season two of this podcast talks about the Cuban Revolution. Very entertaining. The first season is about the Iraq War. Very entertaining, very funny. They have like a cameo with H. John Benjamin. It's really great. I highly recommend it. But
I'll
they
check
talk
that
about
out.
It. But yes, yeah, so like when Castro initially comes to power, he was not a Marxist-Leninist. He was just like a nationalist, like
right.
one of these guys. And Batista was like such a shithead that the United States wasn't like that upset to lose him. And they thought that, so like when the revolution comes, it's different class interests. It's not a purely proletarian or peasant revolt. There also are national bourgeoisie. And like a lot of these third world kind of nationalist movements, it is cross-class. So like the people who own the factories, the bourgeoisie, they also hate the Batista regime. You know, it sucked for them. Now they have a little, so some of their interests are in common, but some of their interests are different because some of those people, what they want is they want to be the ones doing the exploiting of workers and peasants, and they just don't want to share that with foreign people. But then you've got your peasants and workers who like, you know, they want to like actually have real political power. So when Castro comes to power initially, it was not clear whether he was going to be just a liberal democratic leader who had thrown out a corrupt regime, which the United States would have been fine with if not for the fact that Castro started, he started to like nationalize and he started land reform. And that's the best way. If you want to get assassinated,
right. Do a land reform.
Do land reform. It's over. You're cooked. Or nationalize your oil.
Yeah. That's another example.
Yeah, exactly. We've seen that play out so many times. So, so like it was kind of this escalating thing where like Castro begins to favor the lower classes of his coalition and he begins to disfavor American business. And even though he like it's so funny, he literally paid American corporations and the landowners that they took the land from, all these like basically the white rich Cubans whose ancestors had colonized Cuba and brought slave labor over.
Yeah.
Those people, disproportionately wealthy and white, those are all the people that flee to Miami and have been spent the last 50 years whining about it. Cuba is mostly black people.
Right.
Like, Cuba, because there's just this, it's not like there aren't like light skinned white people in Cuba today, or that none of the people who left are, you know, of African ancestry, but it was like that a correlation, if that makes sense.
It makes sense. Yeah. Yeah.
But yeah. So like the United States really didn't appreciate that. And so, you know, the 500 some odd assassination attempts.
Right. Never.
Wiley Coyote ass plot.
That is
cigars.
A perfect, dude. That is a perfect metaphor, whatever, to describe the attempts on all these people. The Wiley Coyote.
So funny.
Well, so, and I'd be fully willing to accept that communism has been any attempt of it has been destroyed by the West and imperial. You know, our sanctions or whatever. I could totally accept that.
Yeah.
But why, like, I guess the boomer question that I'm sure you've been asked is like, if this was is this even a feasible option? Mm-hmm. Like, would this work? Cause it's clear, you know,
sure. Just like the viability of like communism as a system.
Yeah.
Yeah. So, yeah. So that's, let's see. Trying to think where to come at it.
I'm sure it's a yeah.
I think I don't want to like go on like too long or whatnot, but I do think it would be helpful. Like it'd be easier to answer that question if I took a few minutes to like kind of talk about like what is Marxism. Because
I love that, dude. Because I know very little.
Okay, cool. Well, if that's cool with you, I might try to just like give like here's a little crash course.
I would love a crash course.
Your friendly communist dad or whatever. Although I'm not that much older than anybody else. I just got a lot of kids. yeah. So like the reason like I was thinking about this is like I'm trying to remember like things I used to think about like what Marxism was.
Mm-hmm.
And it's really tricky because like what Marxism is probably like is widely misunderstood. And it's misunderstood not just because people like don't want to understand it, but because like the most powerful people in the world don't want people to understand it. you know, I already said like the dermatologists hate her kind of a fact or whatnot,
No.
but yeah, no, there really is like
I'd agree
it
with that.
is
Yeah.
very important for people to not understand it, in my opinion.
I could totally
So I
say.
guess like what I started with is like, what is Marxism not? And what's funny about it is like Marxism is like a lot of times like people's idea of it is literally the opposite of what it actually is. And so like the first thing people will hear like is this idea that it's utopian. Now, like Marxism is not the first socialism. Before Marx, there were many different socialists in like the early 1800s. There's Saint-Simon, there's Robert Owen, Charles Fourier. And these are people who are called the utopian socialists. And their idea was basically like, they looked at the world, and this is what people think of when they think of like Marxism. It's kind of portrayed this way. It was people who looked around at the world and they're like, damn, this shit sucks. How could we make a society that was good?
Yeah.
And then they like drew up their plans and they like planned a little commune and they were going to do it this, that way, and the other. Robert Owen actually like was a capitalist who did this. He was a really cool guy. And they're like, basically, these are like really genuinely earnest people who are just like, they saw the poverty and they saw how much wealth there was next to it. And they thought, what can we do about it? So like when Marx comes along, he looks at this and he says, okay, look, y'all are going about this wrong. You can't draw out from like your imagination, like a perfect society. That's utopianism. And what Marx did is said, to figure out how to get to where we want to go, to get socialism, you have to understand the world and politics and economics scientifically. So like Marx's, you know, Marx's Luigi, Frederick Engels, who was also a capitalist, his dad was owned like a textile factory.
Yeah,
I think
I've
it was.
Heard that name before.
Yeah, Frederick Engels, dude, he's so cool. Like he's a much better writer, in my opinion, than Marx. Like he could write like 2-page like pamphlets that were just like super to the point, which Marx could not help going on for like hundreds of pages about like the value of a yard of linen. It can be very difficult to read Marx. But Lenin wrote this really like a nice succinct book called Socialism, Utopian and Scientific. And basically the idea was like, you have to be able to study and understand like what are the things, what are the laws of physics, but for human society. So for politics and economics and history. And that is what Marx and Engels really set out to develop. And in my opinion, were very successful. The other thing Marxism is not is it's not idealist. A lot of times people like say like, oh, it's too idealistic. It's like, okay, philosophically, there's idealism and there's materialism. And Marxism is a materialist philosophy. But like, it's not like common, like layman's terms, but like in general, what it boils down to is like, idealism is like Plato or Hegel. And it's like, the idea world, the world of spirit, there's this idealistic world, and the physical world we see is merely a reflection of the ideals or spirit. Materialism said gives the opposite. And it says, actually, the ideas of a given time and place are a product of the material conditions that produce them. So like, there's no thought without a brain, without like those chemicals and stuff. So that's like a materialist kind of perspective.
Okay.
But it basically, the way like it kind of plays out is like, there are ideas today, like our ideas about maybe democracy or free enterprise or even socialism and communism. These are ideas that could not have existed 10,000 years ago. People would just like literally be like, what are you talking about? Because world was so different.
Right.
So, and the last thing, like Marxism is not like a religious dogma. It's also not really like a code of ethics. Like people can be dogmatic about Marxism, but to me, that's kind of like, it's something that Marxists are always like whining at other Marxists about is when, oh, you're being dogmatic is like a very common like,
is it?
Insult. Oh yeah. And like every good Marxist has like written about dogmatists. Like Mao talks about the dogmatists are lazy bones in like one of his works. So like, it's like you can be dogmatic about it, but it's kind of like because we view Marxism as scientific, we believe it's self-correcting and it's always evolving as we observe more data and we integrate that into our analysis.
Interesting.
So like being dogmatic would be like if someone like an engineer or physicist really loved Newtonian physics and then Einstein comes along and he's like, no, actually, Einstein, you're wrong. Newton clearly said that mass and right, velocity right. work this way, right? So like, I think Che Guevara actually had a good quote like that, where he's like, yeah, like Marx may be wrong about certain things, but it's in the same way that Newton was right, even if Einstein comes along and like adds nuance to it. Which isn't the thing. It isn't to say not every Marxist. It's easier to be dogmatic than it is to be like flexible and scientific in your thinking. So you will find dogmatic Marxists.
I'm sure.
Maybe
dude.
More than you will find folks who are like more flexible thinkers.
That's humans. Yeah.
Yeah. So I suspect you probably heard some of those. I know I did, the way it was kind of was painted growing up. But as far as like what it is, I would say like Marxism is like an analytical method for understanding the world. And it's a practice informed by that method. So, and like there's a name for the method and it's called dialectical materialism. And what that means is materialism we just talked about. It's like, hey, we understand that like even our own thoughts, even like Marx himself, his thoughts are a product of his time, which is really interesting because when he makes mistakes, you can actually use his idea to critique him. It's like, oh, it would make sense that Marx would maybe have some unwoke moments. He was a 19th century German man living in England.
Right, like, right, right.
Yeah. Makes sense. But so like the dialectics thing is this other thing. And dialectics is basically the idea that like, if you want to understand a thing, you have to examine it not in isolation, but in its relationships to other things. So like, for instance, like what is a husband without a wife? These things depend on each other. They're mutually dependent for like their existence. There's no like meaning. Similarly, like there's no such thing as a master without a slave. So that concept of dialectics, Marx actually got it from Hegel.
Right. Yeah, that's what I was thinking. Yeah, the Hegelian dialectic.
Yeah, Marx freaking loved Hegel. He loved it, but then he was one of what was called the young Hegelians.
No
but
way.
But then what he did is, oh yeah, if you find Hegel interesting, yeah, you should read about like Hegel and Marx because. In Socialism's Utopian and Scientific, Engels writes about this and gives a good summary of it. But basically what Marx did is he took Hegel's dialectics, thesis, antithesis, synthesis kind of stuff.
Yes.
I've not read Hegel, so you probably know more than me.
I know, I only know from other people. So that's, yes. So don't worry.
Yeah.
We're in the same boat.
So like Marx was like, oh my God, Hegel was so smart, but he was going about it backwards. So Marx turned Hegel on his head because Hegel said that Hegel believed in the spirit and like this phenomenology of spirit and that these ideas, their dialectical development is what drives the physical material world. Marx said, actually, dialectics is true, but it's true in the physical material world. And what we see in the idea world is like a reflection of those material changes, which kind of sounds like, I'll give like an example that makes maybe a little more sense. But basically, yeah, so it's kind of like looking at how one thing, how something changes qualitatively over time. Like things aren't static. Like there's a tendency in like a lot of liberal thought to look at things like a taxonomy and to favor formal logic. Like Ayn Rand would be an example, A equals A.
Right.
So like that holds, that's like true enough most of the time that you can think about it. You know, you could think about like a pound of sugar is a pound of sugar. Yeah. Oh yeah, sure. But if you like really look closely, that pound of sugar, you know, some of the sugar crystals are blowing off. Maybe there's some moisture is introduced. It starts to melt. Some of those chemicals are breaking down. Over time, that pound of sugar is not a pound of sugar anymore. Right. And so like, or another example would be like, you can take water and you start to increase the temperature, right? Eventually you hit a boiling point and it has a qualitative change. So that's a dialectical way of looking at things is like, how do we have these qualitative changes? And basically nothing is static. Everything is always in a constant process of change. And the changes it undergoes are part of its interaction with other things. So like evolution is a good example. Like, you know, you can have like a small change in like the anatomy of a duck over time. Eventually that duck is going to evolve until it's not even a duck anymore, right? It's going to be a different species.
Yes.
Fair. So like Marxism is like taking that kind of idea and looking at politics and economics that way. So for example, is like, and when you start to look at history that way, you get to historical materialism. And that is like what Marx is like really famous for. And he has this really great quote: "The history of all hitherto existing society is the history of class struggles."
Ooh.
And so nice quote. For Marx, the things, you know, like in Newton, you've got like mass and velocity, and what are the, you know, things that influence physics? What are the categories? For Marx, looking at history, it is the class struggle between different classes, and a class being like a relationship in the process of like production. So like the most fundamental thing about a society is how you make your bread, how you produce your clothes, how you get shelter. Those are like the most material foundation of like a whole society. And yeah, like as over time classes emerge, right? And you start to have exploiting classes, you know, the masters of Rome and Greece and the slaves, the lords and serfs of feudalism. Today we have the capitalists and the workers, but other categories exist like settlers and natives, colonizers and colonized, and looking at how these things interact with each other and the struggle between these groups with directly opposed interests is what drives history forward, is like the Marxist view. So it kind of helps you understand, like, we used to have, like, you know, 500-600 years ago, folks were sitting around and we had like feudalism and like serfs and shit. Well, how did we get to where we're at today? Like, stuff is very different. And to really understand that, you have to look at the way that like the feudal landowning classes and these new merchants, there was like a struggle, and it was a struggle between one exploiting class, the feudal lords, and another, which is the merchant bourgeoisie. Mm-hmm. And eventually the bourgeoisie, they get the upper hand and they kind of become like the real ruling class, the real seat of power. So like a lot of some of like the conspiracy things or like Masonic lodges and stuff like that is like, to me, it's like very rooted in that context of these class struggles, not necessarily between like the upper class and lower class, but between different upper classes, as you have two different competing but complementary economic systems in this process of one is developing out of the other. So like capitalism emerges out of feudalism, and that's, we still have aspects of,
I never heard that before, but that's an awesome, like, that's awesome. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. So like when we still have like aspects of, so like feudalism's gone, right? Mostly in most of the world.
Yeah.
But we still have landlords. Where do we think that came from? You know, that is a holdover from feudal times. We still have like a fucking Queen of England. You know, there are still feudal arrangements that persist from one stage of history into the next stage of history. And so to loop back onto like your question about like how viable is this?
Yeah.
Like in the Marxist view, what Marx looks at is he looks at this, the central contradiction of capitalism is the contradiction between capital and labor. And capital is wealth that is in the process of being turned into more wealth. It's actually funny. He actually describes it as like having these occult-like powers by which money is transformed into more money. Ooh. And on the appearance of it, it has this very magical character. Love, and I think that for a lot of people, yeah, but what Marx does is he's all about demystifying. He says, okay, what's really going on? He presents this dramatic illusion, and then he explains how the illusionist does it. It's like a debunking video.
That is hilarious, dude. Wow. You are great with metaphors, Brad. You are a beautiful, you should be like a poet or something.
Well, thank you. Mostly that's cribbing off of folks who said it better, but
I didn't hear that, so keep going.
No worries. But yeah, so basically he's like, okay, so what's really going on? And he says, okay, let's look at our worker. It's like a worker works for, you know, 10 hours and he produces a product that's worth $100. The capitalist pays him $50 for his time and pockets the 50 remaining. That 50 remaining is profit. And so what Marx says is he builds off of like David Ricardo, the liberal, you know, and Adam Smith a lot. He really admired them, which I think is maybe surprising to a lot of folks.
Yeah,
he admired them while also he introduced new wrinkles or new dimensions of analysis that they missed. And he said they missed it because they were writing from a bourgeois perspective, whereas Marx is coming from a proletarian perspective. And from the perspective of the worker, when you work for that wage, you are always producing the thing that actually produces value. And this is where he agreed with Ricardo and Smith. What actually produces value is labor time. How much time is required to produce or reproduce that thing? Now, that doesn't mean you can like spend 10 times as long making a scarf as it should have taken you. That won't be worth 10 times as much. So what Marx says, it's actually, what is the socially necessary labor time? Meaning like for a given society at a given level of technology, how long would it take on average to produce a scarf? And if it takes you 2 hours and it takes me 3 hours, our scarf is worth the same in terms of economics. So that's like Marx's kind of like the core of his theory is looking at how value is produced. And what he observed was that when capital employs labor, the laborer is paid less than the value that they produce in the time that they are working. And so that's why he calls it an exploitative system. But it's harder to see. It's not as apparent. It has this magical quality to it that former systems, like if you are a slave, it is very, very obvious. No one is under any illusions about your being exploited, right?
No,
or
no
if you're
illusion.
A feudal serf, if you're like your lord is like, it's Saturday, it's time for you to work for me today, corvée labor. Everyone knows what's going on.
Yes.
But under capitalism, it's not done by the entire person's life hold. There's not like a person is owned for their whole life. And it's not done like in feudalism where like today you work for you on your land and tomorrow you'll work for me, the Lord, on my land. Mm-hmm. That's also very obvious that exploitation is happening. But under capitalism, it's broken down like to the hours. So you may work 5 hours of the day reproducing your own wages. And the last 3 hours of the day, you are producing profit for the capitalist. And so it's kind of hidden. It has this kind of mystical kind of quality.
I'd agree with that. Yeah.
So that's kind of like the core of Marx's analysis. And, but like, because he looks at like history as this process of development and the struggle between opposites. Like I said, like capitalism emerges out of feudalism. It's a very long process. It's not entirely peaceful. In the middle of it, you have most famously the French Revolution.
Ooh,
the French Revolution
yeah.
abolished feudalism and established, it was a revolution of the bourgeoisie against the absolutist feudalist aristocracy. And so you have these revolutions within there. And so to Marxists, what we believe is that if you look at the contradictions in, if you look back at the history of the early part of capitalists' development, you have a mostly feudalist system where most of the exploitation is lords exploiting peasant labor. And you pay taxes to your lord or you give them corvée labor and the lord, maybe he will go and he will expand his wealth by conquering the neighboring duchy and getting access to that title. And then he'll just have like more serfs and land,
yeah,
right?
Right.
Well, that's completely different to how you get ahead under capitalism, which is you figure out how to make your workers more productive and you sell more goods and you expand into new markets. And this is, so you, for a long time, you have these two systems that are integrated with each other that are operating under different logic. But over time, the capitalist class, that bourgeoisie, they are the revolutionary class. They are the class that is doing
wow.
new things. They're creating, they're the ones, a feudal lord has no incentive to make his peasants more
interesting viewpoint.
More productive.
Wow.
Yeah, it's really interesting. Another thing I think is people miss is about like Marx is like, he gives a lot of credit to like the bourgeoisie while also calling them on their shit. Like it's very interesting. Like he's like at one point in the Communist Manifesto, he's like, the bourgeoisie have like had more creative energy in their 150 years of rule than all ruling classes prior to them. And if you look at just like how human societies develop, it's pretty obviously true.
Right.
But for Marxists, what Marx then did is he said, okay, so we see how capitalism and the bourgeoisie gets the upper hand in the feudal system. They get the upper hand against the feudal lords. And they get the upper hand against peasants and workers. And you start to see less lord and serf. More serfs and peasants are thrown off their land during the process of enclosure. So like common lands that the peasants could graze their sheep on, in addition to like their private plots, those get fenced in. And it was this horrible, awful period of time in England where peasants are getting thrown off their land and they're moving to London to try to live and just desperate to survive. Many of them become beggars. There's all these laws against vagrancy. The level of exploitation, it was a much, much more miserable time to be alive than it would have been if you had been like a peasant in like the 1300s.
Totally agree with that. Yes, yes.
People did not, peasant, like people like having access to land. It's just such like a natural, you know, thing people want. I want, you know, my own land. I want to be self-sufficient. But capitalism is very different because a peasant village in feudal times was essentially self-sustaining. You had your blacksmith, you had a healer, you had your priest, you had, you know, a few of these, you know, handy craftsmen. And then most of the people grew their own food and you'd mostly grow your own stuff and then sell the surplus or give taxes to your lord. But capitalism is very opposite of that. Capitalism destroys independence and it forces people into relations of dependence. And so what it also does is it also rapidly increases the productivity of labor. You know, factories and manufacturers, you know, they figured out very early on before there was steam power, they figured out that 100 tailors working in a workshop could produce twice as many like garments as 100 tailors working individually.
Wow.
Because of, yeah. I mean, you think about like how production is done today. Like it occurs, anyone would think like if you're like I was, as an example, I was doing like a food distribution as like a mutual aid network during mm-hmm. COVID. And we would like buy a bunch of food as cheap as we could at Costco. And then we'd box it up into bags of groceries. And we'd make about 50 bags and we'd have like 10 people doing it. And it was all very obvious to us, like, oh, this will probably go a lot faster if we make an assembly line, right? Well, that assembly line idea is like very, it's like part of like the capitalist era because it's a lot faster than having everyone go and I'm going to go grab my apples and I'm going to grab my rice and I'm going to put it in the bag. It would have been a lot slower if we did it as individuals, right?
Dude, yes, absolutely.
So that's how you kind of see, like, that's like before there's factories, there are manufacturers. And that's how like lace begins to be produced. And once you have all those workers in one shop, they start figuring out like, hey, what if we specialized? Instead of all of us doing the same thing and sharing our tools, which is efficient and saves money, what if we also like, hey, I'm just going to do this one type of cloth. I'm only going to do this one part of the process. And you start having this division of labor, which has this double effect. Marx is always talking about these contradictions and these kind of like ironies. And it's like, on the one hand, it reduces the worker to very menial tasks repeated ad infinitum and kind of turns the person into a machine or a cog in the machine. But on the other hand, collectively, it means that you can produce 2, 3, 4, 5 times as much shit in the same time as a group that you used to, right?
Yeah.
But the problem for Marx is he looks at this and he says, wow, what is it? What he calls is, he says, this is socialized production. Production is no longer an individual activity. It is a social process involving hundreds of moving parts and workers working together. People are learning cooperation. They're learning cooperation and they are learning how much more powerful they are collectively. And it is capitalism itself that does this. Capitalism organizes everything in this way as often as it can. And so if you look at a factory, it's not, I'm not going to go make a car. Like literally things today could not even exist if some individual tried to produce it. Like no one could make a computer on their own, let alone the computer, the operating system, the internet infrastructure, you know? These are collective social processes. But the problem is, while the process is collective and social, the profit is expropriated by a private individual. So you have this collective process that goes towards enriching the capitalist himself. And so what Marx said is like, in the same way that the capitalist mode of production, you know, these relationships, this process, this way of working, it displaced the feudal mode of production, which was less efficient, Marx says, hey, there's some problems with this private appropriation. Number one, it's exploitative. But there are other problems too, because like, think about like financial crises. Marx explained in 1850s, Marx predicted that every roughly 10 years, there would be an economic crisis.
Wow, really?
He predicted that like way back in the day. And he did that based...
Mm-hmm. No, I was going to say, what did he give a reason why he made that prediction? Because the central banks weren't, they were in England and a few other places.
Yeah. You're right. The banking had not developed fully yet. And one of the things that's really interesting where Lenin becomes very important, and also later writers like Kwame Nkrumah, who wrote about neocolonialism, but like Lenin writes about kind of how that some of the banking developments matured. But what Marx did is he looked at, okay, how, like, why does a capitalist invest in producing something? It's to produce a profit, right?
Mm-hmm.
Now, if I look at the market and I cannot expect to make a profit with let's say I just earned another $10,000 profit on my existing business. Now, if I look and I see, actually, I don't think I'll be able to sell this if I invested in my business, what am I going to do? I'm going to sit on it. I'm going to hoard it. I might put it into a bond, right?
Right.
So you put it into saving of some kind to prevent, because at this point you're not going to be able to grow your money. So you have to protect your capital, right?
Right. Right.
And when that happens, if let's say basically Marx described what we call the business cycle, but he did it in using slightly different terms that like liberal economists would come around later and kind of invent slightly different terms that weren't as threatening or didn't really lay blame as much on things. But basically it was like, there's this contradiction for the capitalist, where the capitalist on the one hand wants to produce as much profit as possible. Mm-hmm. And so if you're going to employ workers, there's lots of ways you could do that. If you can produce the same amount, if you can hire fewer workers to make the same amount of shit, you're going to do it, right? And you are going to pocket the difference. Or if you reduce their wages, or if you make them work longer hours. Longer hours use was the very original way that capitalists made their money. In the early mid 1800s, the kind of hours people worked, like
insane,
absolutely insane. Like it's truly horrifying. Like literally on a par with like some of the exploitation of like slavery.
Like those little kids. I remember reading like the one they would, they would say like the bed never got cold because they had these shifts and they would just switch the kid in the same bed. Yep. I mean, it was disgusting.
Yeah, it's really horrifying.
Yeah.
So like that was like the original, like Marx like looked at that. And he was like, okay, so eventually people hate working 16, 18 hour days. People hate that. And eventually they struggle against it, right? But the other way you could reduce or increase profits is by reducing wages. So if you pay people even less money than they need to like survive, or where like some of them are going to starve to death, but as long as enough live that the class of workers continues, it's like a very different dynamic than like if you own someone as a slave,
right?
You don't want to squander your investment.
Yes, yes.
But if you have a class of hyper exploited workers, well, what's the death rate? You know, it's like, well, it's not my worker that died. I'll just get a new one. You know, so there's like, obviously there are like uniquely horrible things about slavery. Right. I never want to short sell that.
No, you're right. I understand.
Well, but there's these conversations between like the slave proponents, like Jefferson Davis, and like the industrialists. And they're like, look at you. You're all, they basically called each other's hypocrisy out. It's kind of funny, but
well, I remember reading in I don't know which, but like the like the New Deal and all that stuff in the 20s and 30s, that Rockefellers, they funded that because they knew how horrible they were doing, and so they said, we're going to give you health insurance because we care. Yeah. And it's not because they cared; it's because they wanted to keep. They realized it was more expensive to have to train somebody new, so they're going to give them a few days off and health insurance. Yeah. And it was just a ploy because they knew the workers were about to totally freak out. And so they plied them with that and they said, perfect, now we're good.
That's totally correct. Yeah, there was, and what's interesting is like, and Marx always knows this, is like there have always been like more far-seeing capitalists. Like, you know, a class may be an exploitative class, but that doesn't mean everyone within it is the same. And there's always interesting figures. Like Marx points out, like lots of times he quotes like these factory inspectors that were hired in England, and they went in and they observed what they saw, and they're just like horrified. So it's like you got to promote stability. But what I was saying though is, so there's this contradiction. So like the capitalist on the one hand wants to pay his workers as little as possible to enlarge his share of the profits, you know, proceeds of labor that goes to labor share and capital share, right? Everyone kind of gets that, you know, how much goes to labor, how much goes to profit. But the problem is, if you do that, now those workers are not only workers, they are also consumers of products.
Ooh.
So if your workers, if you're producing products that are consumed by the working class, it's different if you're producing like Teslas or luxury items, but if you're producing Cokes and hamburgers and bread, if you pay your workers less and your competitors pay their workers less, now you've made the working class so poor that they can't afford to buy your products. Mm. And so when that happens, once you're able to reduce wages in order to inflate profits, eventually you have what Marx calls a crisis of overproduction. And this is a uniquely capitalist phenomenon. There were no crises of overproduction in feudal times, and there have not been any crises of overproduction in socialist countries.
Right,
this
that
is
makes
a uniquely
sense.
it's like remember the housing crisis 2008. Think about the absurdity of, we built too many houses.
Right.
Now everyone has to be houseless. You know, it's preposterous, but
yeah.
It's this contradiction between your, as a capitalist, your personal interest is to pay your workers less. But as a class, it is in your collective interest as the capitalist to have workers with enough money to buy your own products. So there's this contradiction there that plays out. And how it plays out is it doesn't come to an equilibrium. It lurches. And so you'll have like, when you have a crisis and like wages, you know, go down, those people aren't buying shit. Eventually it gets to the point, you know, where it bottoms out and capitalists realize, hey, wow, workers are so desperate. There's so much unemployment that I can pay my workers half what I used to. I'm going to start increasing production again because I can pay them so little. So you start producing more, right? You hire those workers. They're just glad to get a job. They'd rather have a job than be the person without a job and starving. So you start producing. Now you start selling, right? Mm-hmm. Well, then your competitors are doing the same. And now, hey, the workers are like, hey, you need more workers, right? So maybe you hire more of them. Maybe now, because there's less unemployment, they start asking for better wages. So you start paying them more. The general prosperity is going up. The amount of stuff you produce is going up. But then those workers, eventually you reach like a glut point where like you've produced so much. There's no mechanism for saying, hey, actually we should stop producing more. That's like a mechanism capitalism doesn't really have. And so what it does is everyone, if you and I both produce shoes, and we are just, it's like markets booming, baby. We are just producing as many shoes as we can. Suddenly we realize, oh my God, we're not going to be able to produce enough shoes. Now it's a race between you and me to unload all our shoes, because those shoes are like, those shoes are capital crystallized into a commodity. And we want that capital to get back to money so we can continue this process. But if it doesn't sell, that is value that just goes poof, right?
Hmm.
And so like, we realize, oh, I can't produce. I'm not going to be able to sell these shoes. I'm going to cut my labor force in half. So we both cut our labor force in half. Now there's more poverty. Now even fewer people can buy the shoes that we are making. So like that's this kind of crisis. And it's very interesting the way like Marx like constructs the argument. He just like starts with, he looks at the capitalist and says, what are his interests? He looks at the workers and say, what are their interests? So there's this competing interest between workers want to get paid more and have more to live. Mm-hmm. Capitalists want to maximize profit, but also capitalists have to compete with other capitalists, because if you just decide to pay your workers more, you're going to not make enough profit. Then you won't be able to afford the new machinery that your competitor does. And it kind of plays out over time.
Can I ask, the one big question that I wanted to ask you was like all this stuff. I totally agree with. I agree with that. But so the guy I think I talked about in the messages is mm-hmm. Anthony Sutton. So he wrote like this three series on how mm-hmm. Wall Street funded all these, so funded Hitler, they funded the Bolsheviks. So, and he said the goal is, or his opinion was that these robber mm-hmm. barons, they want a corporate socialist model where they're the mm-hmm. monopoly. There is no other option. Everyone works at the Amazon pod, mm-hmm. you know, those jokes. And so that's what he said the real goal was. So how would you stop like communism? Mm-hmm. How would you stop somebody like a Jeff Bezos or an Amazon from dominate? Like what, like, do you have to have the state or what, how does this balance out?
Yeah, that's a great question. So like, again, thinking about like how, you know, capitalism develops out of feudalism. Capitalism has this logic we just described, right? But there's basically the logic of capitalism is, you know, also because of competition, because the way one capitalist gets over on another capitalist is by making his workers more efficient. Well, that requires more investing in what Marx calls constant capital, which is like means of production. That's like machines or like mm-hmm. the stuff that you're producing, right? The problem with constant capital or like machines is they don't actually earn any profit on their own. They only earn profit. The only profit comes out of human labor that you working those machines. So like over time, because you and I are competing to make more shoes faster, we have this arms race of technology where we're trying to build bigger and better factories, right?
Yeah.
So that we can have fewer workers making more shoes, right?
Right.
Well, the problem is if everything stayed the same, which it never does, mm-hmm. you and I would both make more profit each paying 1,000 workers to make shoes than we would by paying 100 workers to make shoes. The reason we reduce the number of workers we hire is because if you find a way to only to make the same number of shoes with 100 workers and it takes me 1,000 still, guess what? You can lower your prices. You can undercut me and you can put me out of business. So it doesn't matter what I want. Over time, we're gonna find a way to use 100 workers instead of 1,000. But the problem is that means that there more capital has to be invested to produce less profit. And Marx called this the tendency of the rate of profit to fall. And he said that basically there's lots of factors that go on and lots of things can change this. But in general, over time, the tendency within any industry is going to be towards falling profit rates because you have to put more money into bigger and better machines and fewer workers, which means you will make less profit because of the system. And the other thing he said is that capital is going to concentrate. Basically, monopoly capitalism is as inevitable as increasing entropy in physics.
Interesting.
So that is going to happen. And what's really interesting, and this is where like Marxists like differentiate, like people have, I think people a lot of times conflate like left liberals with like Marxists, which is kind of funny. but like what a Marxist answer would be is like, yeah, you're going to see the emergence of an Amazon. You can't fight that actually, because the state that would implement these antitrust laws is controlled by the people that have an interest in it. Right. So it's never going to work. What we say is that's just let them. The Marxist answer is literally let them do it. And then we can put Jeff Bezos on his rocket and send him to Mars. And we are already running this shit ourselves. What do we need him for?
True.
We don't need them for. And so that is kind of the answer is like, you can just nationalize it at that point because the capitalists, and this is what Marx says, he says, the capitalists will sell us the rope with which we'll hang them.
Oh, that's a beautiful quote. Wow.
So like, as far as like, you know, I suspect that, what was the guy's name again? The economist you were mentioning?
Anthony Sutton is his name.
Anthony Sutton. Yeah. So I've heard this theory before. And so like, I can see why someone might make this idea that like, because it is absolutely true, Wall Street invested in Bolshevik Russia. Mm-hmm. Now I would mention that before they did that, they also invaded in the, in 1920, or 1919, 1920, 14 nations invade. It was called the, I think the Northern Expeditionary Force. And basically Russia, after the Bolsheviks take over, there's a civil war where the capitalists and the old Tsarist landowners and Tsarist elements and basically proto-fascists who are called the Black Hundreds The White Army.
Heard that name before.
The Black Hundreds were basically, they were horrible, like, pogromists who would just, like, massacre Jews and just, like, carry out, like, very, very, very Prussian, very, not reminiscent, I don't know, foreshadowing kind of what the Nazis would do.
Okay.
And so they were, like, the one of the groups that were fighting in this White Army. Well, all these capitalist countries, even though they had just fought World War One, they're all very weak. If they hadn't been weak, they probably never would have been able, they probably would have succeeded in this war. But the, also the Bolshevik Revolution wouldn't have happened without the crisis of World War One that like obliterated Tsarism.
Right.
So like the White Army gets support from all these capitalist countries, including the United States. We invaded Russia, the Soviet Union in 1918. They try to do what Kurt Churchill said, which is crush Bolsheviks, smother Bolshevism in its cradle.
Damn.
But they failed. They failed. And the Bolsheviks, the Red Army, they defeated all of these forces. Wow. But the issue is that like Russia before, even before World War One, Russia was what we call like a semi-peripheral economy. So like they were kind of part of the West, but also not. They were kind of like spreading Western capitalism towards the East. They were colonizing Central Asian people. And those nations were in horrible, horrible state of oppression. Like what is now Kazakhstan, when the Bolshevik Revolution happened, there were less than 1,000 high school graduates in that region. By the time the Bolsheviks, by the time the collapse of the USSR, Kazakhstan had more college graduates than France.
Wow.
So,
like,
so anyway, so like it's really hard. It's often very like it's just not mentioned in my experience when I grew up learning about these things, how far behind Russia was, even before World War One and the Civil War. Russia was so far behind Western Europe in terms of manufacturing. They had very little capital. Most of it was feudal. They mostly had these lords and they had peasant agriculture and you had small petty producers and you had a few rich peasants, the kulaks, who were basically like agricultural capitalists and they would hire like day laborers. So it's this very backwards, could not competitive economy at all. And that's before World War One that killed like World War One and the Civil War killed like 4 or 5 million people, so including 1 or 2 million deaths by starvation.
Yeah. So this is, I had another book called The History of Central Banking, and he talks a lot about Imperial Russia in a good light. So I just pulled it up. Like, I'm not trying to debate, but I would love you. So talks about like how Russia exceeded wheat production by bigger than Argentina, Canada, and US by 25%. They produced 80% of the world's flax, like all these, you know, on and on and on. And so obviously he's anti-central bank and anti-Bolshevism.
Is he talking about Tsarism or?
Yeah. So like he talks highly of Tsar Alexander II and then how his point was, this was his point. Once they got rid of the central banking, because I guess it was existed for a little bit in like the mid 1800s or late 1800s, and they kicked it out. And the moment they did that, their production and all this stuff, just, you know, they dominated. They did real well. So that that's a question I have.
What
date
did he say? What date was that?
So by like 1914, that was when 83, like all this their national debt was less than 2%. It was funded by the Russian state highways. They exceeded commercial canal tonnage by 11 million. British were 10 million.
Tsarist Russia was definitely, they were developing. They were at a point where they were starting to develop a capitalist style economy and it was changing rapidly. And there were a lot of reforms that had happened. But like it took England centuries to go from peasant agriculture to what it became.
Yeah.
And Russia was like literally probably about 100 years behind. But here's the problem with it though. Like Russia was in this spot, and this is another important like contradiction that Marxists talk about a lot. So like, again, and that getting back to the idea of like nothing develops in a vacuum, things are always connected. Once capitalism exists in one country, capitalism is not free to develop in the same way out of feudalism in other countries, because that capitalist country, they immediately set about opening up the world to their market to their goods. So as soon as capitalism emerges in Europe, suddenly all of these peasant producers who don't have the advantage of collective labor, essentially socialized labor, benefits of what we believe will be the basis of socialism, which is working together. Mm-hmm. So a lot of these other countries, the value of their goods is just devastated. So like the value of textiles in India and China is gutted. The value of corn and rice in countries where you're producing it by hand, it becomes very low. And so not only that, but like if you have an advanced, you know, Acme 1000 factory or machine that you are using to produce shoes, and I am trying to move from being a handmade tailor or a shoemaker, mm-hmm. I'm trying to get together and start my own little capitalist shoemaking enterprise. I can't just buy like a very simple machine. I have to find the capital to buy your fancy machine or I can't compete, right? True. So who do I go to? Who has the capital to invest in my project? It's you in your country. It's you in England, you in France. So if I'm a Russian wannabe capitalist looking to develop a capitalist enterprise, I don't already have probably the capital to invest in my own machinery. I also don't have the engineers and the expertise and the existing expertise and machinery to do it. So who do I have to go to? I go to French and English and German banks and American banks, and I get them to invest, right? Well, guess what? Now they own part or maybe even a controlling part of my shit. So one of the things Lenin talks about is like the Russian bourgeoisie was dependent upon the English and French bourgeoisie because of finance capital, because of what he called capital export. Capital export was where, like, in addition to exporting your cheap commodities you make in the core country, the metropole, like England or, you know, London or Paris, Berlin, you're also going to export capital. You're going to export and you're going to do foreign investment is capital export, direct foreign investment. And so a lot of this Russian capital, you look under the hood, it's really British and French capital. It's not like a nefarious plot. It's just like they invested, they provided the seed capital to make, because they want these factories, you know, where workers are living 5 years because of the horrible air quality.
So what's like, your, sorry.
No, yeah. Right. What are you saying?
I wonder, what's your take? So like on Conspiracy World, which I'm sure you've seen, mm-hmm. we blame the central banking on everything.
Yeah.
So what is your view as a on central banking and the fiat currency and this, like, you know, this fractional reserve, which is debt slavery. But what's your, in your worldview, how does this fit? Does it fit in? Does it not?
Sure. So I think, like, for me as a Marxist, like, banking is a product of like the capitalist mode of production. And like what banking basically does is if you've got a little bit of capital scattered all around the surface of your country or of the world, banking allows you to scoop up all that extra capital and provide enormous loans to finance enormous infrastructure projects like railroads. So without the credit system, things like building railroads and giant canals and things like that would not really have been possible. So the scale of production needs this banking system. But basically the kind of like the contours I would look at is like, finance capital is absolutely like the bane of the world. Like it is literally it costs a lot of human lives.
Yeah.
If you look at countries like Jamaica, have you ever heard of like the Manly government in Jamaica?
I have not, but
so in like the night. So, okay. So like, just like storytelling kind of big picture, like, so like all these imperialist banks, they're dividing the world between them. You have all these cartels forming, you have these associations like Rockefeller and you have DuPont and you've got, you know, all these just massive monopoly associations. Lenin wrote about that a lot and how they basically control or are essentially synonymous with their respective governments, and they're all looking to get a bigger share of the pie globally. So they're all looking for colonies to get the resources out of. They all want to go find some little African child and force them down into a cobalt mine so that we can build our iPhones and have them for, you know, the
2 years.
American workers are going to be exploited. Yeah, exactly. Also, yeah, it doesn't need to last long. In fact, the quicker it breaks, the better. So all that great fun stuff we all are so familiar with. But like, a lot of it has to do with like that finance capital is like directly connected to state power, political power, and military power. And so it's kind of like the United States model is essentially like the United States is like the seat of global finance capital, and the United States government and the United States military are its enforcement wing. The same way a mob boss would prefer to just have things running smoothly. Like a mob bosses don't go around whacking people just like for shits and giggles. They do it if like someone is like threatening the profitability of their enterprise, right? So to me, the US military, it has these two purposes. One is if a country begins to wants to do land reform or keep their resources for themselves, you got to go let them know, hey, you're not allowed to do that.
Right. Yes.
And then the second one is, and I think a lot more people understand this now, is like the whole, it's like when capital can't find, or if you're a capitalist and you produce a bunch of something and you can't sell it, that's like really bad. And you lose a ton of money, right?
Mm-hmm.
And it risks precipitating one of these recessions, you know, one of the economic crises. That's often like a big loss of investment like that, or a bubble is what happens. So like as capital builds up, you overproduce, you create a bubble, and then it pops, right? And there's a big recession, all that shit. Well, one of the ways that they kind of draw out or prevent that or slow it down is through, one of the answers was Keynesianism. And that was like demand side. It was like you give people money from the government so that they could buy stuff, so that even when they lose their jobs, they can still continue to purchase things so they can keep demand up.
Interesting,
right?
Dude. Yeah. Yeah.
But another way you can do it, what they did is like the downside of that is it tends to create, it tends to make workers a little less dependent on their bosses. Because if I know that I'm going to have health insurance, if I know that I'm not going to literally die by not having a job, maybe I'm a little more willing to risk unionizing my workplace or demanding better wages. So that has its downsides. So what they've done instead is now the United States, ever since like the 70s was a big transition era at a point. I'm sure you've, you know, thought about like New World Order and all that stuff and Trilateral Commission. But like the preferred model today is to just use the military as a way to just absorb surplus capital. It's just
That's
like
true.
Literally
yeah.
like the corporate, like you get like a quote, corporate quote unquote socialism, where it's like, and I say I'm kind of laughing calling it socialism because it's kind of like that's what liberals think of socialism. They think about it being focused on how you distribute the existing wealth, but that's not really like Marxism is actually about like how you produce the wealth in the first place. And then what you do with it, not just like redistributing it without changing the underlying system. But yeah, so like the military is like a sink for excess capital, and the state and the banking system has this elasticity where you can absorb lots of the surplus capital without entering an economic crisis as fast, you know?
Right. Yes. No, I didn't. And then this will be our last question, but I agree with so many of the things you say. Mm-hmm. So what would you do about like globalism? Cause I think that's you a globalist or are you more of a nationalist? Cause Stalin, I know you're not a Stalinist or whatever, but he was more of a nationalist, correct? So
it's kind of I'm trying to think of a term. So like there's different types of nationalism. And like, basically it's like, if you're a nationalist and you're like in Western Europe, that's like really bad because you're basically that always amounts to like a chauvinism or like, we're going to go conquer you because we're superior. Mm. But for countries that were colonized and like their cultures were like eradicated or just attempted to be destroyed, like in Algeria or lots of Africa, Southeast Asia, nationalism there is like, basically just saying, no, we are humans. We have a culture that's valuable. We can have independence. We want to be economically more independent. We don't want to depend on these big, bad, countries that treated us horribly for centuries. So I would definitely say I support nationalism in the third world. I'm a big supporter of that. And I would say that even if there is a bourgeois government, for instance, an Iran, or, you know, maybe arguably a Venezuela, even though their governments are not like socialist, or Venezuela is kind of an in-between, I would support them because to me, like the system of imperialism and capitalism, and imperialism is inextricably tied up with, but it's also a little bit not, it's not only, it's you can't separate it from finance capital, but it's not just finance capital and banks. So like my kind of difference with someone like who's, you know, real thinks a lot about like the banks and stuff, mm-hmm. is try to expand and understand the banking system as an integral part of a greater whole. And you have to look also at the system of production, how the goods and services that are purchased with that bank money are produced, where they're produced, who controls the process of production, how they compensate the workers who make them, where they go and where they flow. So as far as globalism goes, I think that globe, like the idea of like, I kind of feel a little unsure because I think that sometimes the word globalist is used in ways that kind of like imagine what I consider like more anti-Semitic tropes. It can always like veer into that.
So it does, it absolutely can. I would agree with you. Yeah.
That's its own. That's a whole another interesting topic, by the way. I'd love to.
We're going to do it again. So don't worry.
Yeah. So definitely. I'll look forward to it. So I'll put a pin in that. But I would say globalization is an undeniable phenomenon and one that has increased over time.
Yeah.
But globalization is an inevitable product of capitalist development, where before in early capitalism or in feudalism, if you could be a shoemaker in your town and I'd be a shoemaker in my town, and that's right. Cool. I'm going to make for my market. You're going to make for your market. But capitalism creates a single unified global market. And what that means is that your shoemaking operation and mine are now going to be in competition. They're going to get consolidated. Eventually, someone with a bunch of money, even if you put all like 12 shoemakers in your region out of business and become the shoemaker, you're probably going to sell out to someone with even more capital who's running an even bigger shoe operation, like the next like state over.
Right.
So eventually the capital centralizes. Capital centralization and monopoly formation creates banking capital, creates the finance capital system that we know, and we see its effects. But globalization is like, you know, we you've probably seen that meme or that picture. It's like a can of a plastic thing of fruit, and it says grown in Argentina.
Oh yes, packaged, yes, yes. Yeah. It's like going all over the world,
yeah. Like being sold in California.
Yeah,
like that's a real thing that to me is very bad. Because like obviously like the climate change, carbon emissions and stuff of that. And also just, so like for me, I'm definitely for, I'm not a free trader. I think that countries that, what I would want to see would be a decoupling. So countries that are historically exploited, I would like for them to have the economic ability to create tariffs to protect them from the cheap goods of the already developed world. And I want them to be able to develop, in a relationship of like solidarity and mutually beneficial trade with their neighbors. At the same time, building towards like food self-sufficiency. I think that's really important. I think that like having different areas, because like capitalism will like look at like here, like I live in Hawaii. Hawaii used to produce no shortage of food for its population, right? And we still could, but we don't, because it is more profitable for the people who own most all the land to do tourism and to do like real estate deals. And that, so now Hawaii,
that's a great point, dude. That is a great, because they survived for thousands of years on Hawaii.
They had a great thing going. They had enough free time to invent surfing. and then Captain Cook showed up and things went really downhill. And
right.
You know, now Oahu's water has been poisoned by the Navy, and we're at risk of losing our single aquifer that serves the whole island where Honolulu is. It's another current event. But yeah, that's a product of capital is calling the shots. So like capital has it's like got its mind of its own. And I think that like parts of like this, where I think conspiracy is really interesting, a lot of it to me is like capital is like this, can be this spooky, inhuman, like object, and it's very dehumanizing, and it operates in a way. Marx called this idea, called it commodity fetishization, and he basically said that like the commodities that we engage with, they kind of mediate our relationships with each other, and it, and they're this mysterious force that demands things of us, and we kind of worship them almost in a sense, but because they're, it's like mysterious, it's like hidden for us. And he compared it to what at that time people thought like indigenous religions were about, like, you know, spirits inhabiting things. And so like I think there's like definitely these very interesting elements of like yeah, where like capital's, the way capital works, it's very easy I think sometimes to like transpose that onto like individual actors, or like imagine that like there are like it, like if you squint you can see some of the more maybe absurd seeming kind of conspiracies. A lot of times to me they reflect there is like a reality that they're reflecting. It's kind of like a poor, like not necessarily seeing the whole picture of these systems that I do agree are like very bad or not. But as far as like what I like, as far as like back to like what I would change, or like what I think would happen, or how sustainable, in the same way that capitalism emerged from feudalism and retained features of feudalism, like socialism will emerge from capitalism.
Ooh.
But that doesn't mean that we are going to get rid of markets and money overnight, even banks, things like that. They will, however, serve different purposes, and we will build new kinds of relations and ways of producing things, ways of living with each other. And that will be based not on the profit motive where, you know, like in Hawaii, like we just said, what can we get the most profit out of? Great, that's what we're going to use the land for. That's basically how all decisions are made today, is like more or less, how can I squeeze the most profit out of this? It's this, it's a very rational process of pursuing a socially irrational end, accumulation for accumulation's sake. You know, like Marx said, kind of ironizing, he's like, accumulate, accumulate. That is Moses and the prophets, wow, describing like the the mindset of capitalism.
Yeah, dude, so, it like, is. You're right.
So I think that like, yeah, I think the good things of capitalism is basically just like, we're going to take the good things of capitalism that capitalism is already doing. Things like the existence of an Amazon is like, hey, that's kind of cool and useful, or could be made to be put to good use. You know, things like Google, that's pretty cool, you know, to be able to like have this information at your fingertips.
Mm-hmm.
But what if this was put under a democratic ownership and control by the people that use it, and the purpose was not to squeeze every last drop of profit out of us, but rather like to just to meet our needs? Then you can like make those decisions on a rational basis based on like human needs and wants and collective interest, rather than on the basis of what will a particular capitalist get the most money out of, which is kind of like the root of a lot of these problems.
Dude, I made it perfect sense, Brad. So we got to do another show, because you gave me because I know I just know like the boomer stuff about communism, you know, like the memes. So this was very enlightening, and I'm sure a lot of the people that listen to the show, they probably didn't know. So the next one, we'll get into some other the topics we didn't touch on. But do you have anything to like promote, or where people could find you, or anything like that?
You can follow me on Twitter at Your Communist Dad. You are not YOUR. I've got does this chat like get persisted anywhere or whatever?
It doesn't get, it just will be on YouTube. But
okay, cool. I may send you like a few links to a couple particular things I mentioned.
In them at the top, absolutely. So yeah,
cool.
Yeah,
yeah.
Perfect, dude. Well, we're gonna definitely do this again. And
yeah, I had fun, Jeff.
I like learned a lot, so much, dude. That's how I value if I learned anything. So I learned so much, dude. And thanks for doing this. And you have a good night. Yeah, all right.
Next time we'll have more conversation. I know I kind of talked.
Oh no, dude. I love you. I had nothing to add. So it was beautiful. It was perfect. So Brad, thank you, dude. And we'll talk soon. All right.
All right, talk soon.
All right, man. Take care.
Bye.
Bye.